It did grip me, just not as much, okay? Stop, I know what you're thinking.
Especially on the bottom half of the books. You feel like you're just slamming the books, like, well, this book is on the bottom because of this one.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This
is Talking Beasts.
Welcome back. It's our season premiere of Talking Beasts, the Narnia podcast. This is Glumbuddle.
And this is Rillian.
Really good to have you back, Rillian.
Good to be back.
Yeah, if you obviously, most of you probably heard Rillian come in at the very end of the lightning round episode at the end of the last season. So thanks for being back, Rillian. It's really great to have you again. So it's a lot has happened this summer, or maybe a lot hasn't happened. Mostly been stuck at home.
Yeah, I saw, of course, every place in the U.S. is in a different, or world is in a different level of lockdown or whatever. I saw this fantastic Twitter thread where this guy found a textbook cover, a college physics textbook cover that in the color scheme matched every one of Taylor Swift's outfits for like the last 2 years. And I thought, this is someone under lockdown.
Yes, so I haven't had the time to go that far, but what I have had the time to do is, for the first time in years, rank all seven of the Chronicles of Narnia books from seven to one.
That's not the first time.
It's not the first time, but the first time in many years. I'm sure I did a list several years ago, but it's been a long time. And if you'd asked me, where does Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe rank, you know, or whatever, probably would have said, it's probably about here or something. This is the first time in years I've really sat down, giving it a lot of serious thought, and said, okay, I want to make my definitive list. This is how I would rank the seven Chronicles of Narnia books. My favorite books ever. So that's what we are going to do today, ranking all seven Narnia books and kind of asking the question, how do you do that? How do you take these books you love so much and say, this one's four, this one's five? How do you, I think choosing your number one and your number seven is fairly easy, but how do you choose between the ones in the middle is a little more tricky. Speaking of busy summer, by the way, you'll notice you'll hear a crying baby on my end occasionally, possibly your end too.
Congratulations.
Yep, this is the first episode dealing with that. So just be aware of that. Thanks for all the congrats from everybody in the Facebook group and such. It's going to be quite a season. We'll commemorate the 70th anniversary of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, so the beginning of Narnia, as well as in December, the 15th anniversary of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie. One thing we're going to start doing for our supporters on Patreon is we're going to start basically a sort of post show. After this episode's over, we're just going to keep the mics on, and whatever happens, happens, and we're going to put that we're going to post that to Patreon. So a little exclusive podcast series, show after the show. If you want to sign up for Patreon, just go to patreon.com/NarniaWeb. But here we go. I've been waiting for so long to hear your list. We're going to rank the seven Chronicles of Narnia books. Before we get started, what was kind of your process? How did you go about? Did you just do it all in your head? Or what was kind of your process narrowing down these books? And when was the last time you think you did that?
Last time I did it, I'm sure it was on the podcast, spur of the moment, the way we do things. and yes, it's always all in my head. I'm not exactly I'm kind of a fly by the seat of your pants, going guns blazing kind of guy.
By the time this episode gets posted, it may list may totally be different.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, okay, I can't overthink this. I got to just do it, kind of gut instinct, just throw it out there. So I just quickly made the list, right? And then a few days later, I kind of reapproached it and thought, does this hold true? And there were some methodologies I kind of thought about, but some of them just didn't work. Like, I thought about, okay, if I were trapped on a desert island and I could only take three of the Narnia books, or let's say, like, the Narnia books were going to be lost, right? And I could only read three of the Narnia books to my kids. Which three would they be? And I thought, well, that doesn't really answer, because I would probably do it in the first three that were published. Because Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, and Voyage of the Dawn Treader are such a nice trilogy. But so if I had to keep just... But that's not my three favorites. Like just those three wouldn't be my three top one, two, and three. And so I think what I kind of did, because ultimately what we're asking is like, which ones do you like the most? I think I just asked, well, which books am I constantly thinking back to the most? Whether it's quotes, whether it's themes, whether it's characters, which ones just kind of come to mind? Like if I'm having a conversation with, you know, my wife or family member or something, and I just say, you know, it's kind of like in the Chronicles of Narnia that, and then I'll bring it up. And I'm not going to say I applied that logic strictly, but probably in terms
you
of
you better.
Just,
I'm going to hold you to that, okay? You've just committed to it.
So there was that. And then at some point, I just think, you know, which ones have I kind of reread the most? The best way I could sum up my reasoning is, which books do I come back to the most in terms of thinking and in terms of actually reading them?
Yeah. And like I said, I think 1 and 7 are fairly easy for most people probably. But man, when choosing between 4 and 5, how do you do that? And I think I tried to do the same thing as you initially. I tried to have the initial list. You know, I sat on my basement floor on the carpet and just put all the books in front of me and just started moving them around. And I tried to, not to spend more than like 30 seconds on the initial list. Don't think too much about it. And then, but from there, even with that kind of go with your gut kind of mentality, I still was like, I don't know, this 4 or 5, I don't know. And then with that, I kind of used my intellect to break the tie. I'd go, okay, let's think about these two books, you know? So I'd start with emotion, then usually use more intellectual reasons to fine tune it a bit. So that's how I kind of ended up. And I definitely am surprised by my list. Like, it's almost like if you just said, oh, where's Magician's Nephew? I'd say, oh, it's about here, you know, before I'd kind of casually say where it was. I think that my list has ended up almost flip-flopped from what I've been kind of casually saying for years. And there is one in particular that I am stunned by that'll be in the near the end of this episode. I'll make a revelation that I make a change to what I've been saying for a long time on this show about where a particular book ranks. Really? Am I saying this is it? Am I saying this goes there? And I'm like, you know, yeah. And it's kind of a gut thing, probably. It's slightly more than an intellectual thing. But it's like, man, I can't get away from it. So I got to go re-edit some of those older episodes and change it, update it. I'm super excited. Would you say you were generally surprised by it? Were there any big surprises on your list?
No, unlike you, I'm not constantly surprising myself.
Well, what can I say? Well, I think that's as far as we can go without giving away what's going on here. So let's go ahead and jump in, ranking the 7 Chronicles of Narnia books. And we're going to start at the bottom and work our way to our favorite books and go back and forth and see how that goes.
So you want to alternate on who goes first with each book?
Sure, we can do that. Though I think with this first one, it shouldn't matter because if I'm not mistaken, unless something's changed in the past couple of years, our number 7s are actually the same.
Now you go first. You go first. No, because it's changed for me.
No, what? Seriously?
Yes. So
oh
you go
my
first.
Gosh!
You go
wow, first. Drama you go first. Already. Okay. Well, my bottom of the list, my number 7 out of 7 remains Prince Caspian. And that is, well, that is, and here's the thing. Here's kind of, let me just say this once so I don't have to keep on saying it 50 times throughout the episode. These are 7 great books, and even 7 out of 7, it's still one of my favorite books ever. That's the kind of the point of this episode is how do you choose? There are 7 great books. How do you narrow it down? That's the point of the episode. We'll have to say some positive and we'll have to say a lot of negative things about each book to probably kind of explain why it ended up where it did. But there's 7 awesome books. That's what makes this so hard. And I feel bad about Prince Caspian because I feel like whenever I kind of mention it in passing on the podcast, it's usually something like, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's the least favorite. Or I'll say something kind of negative about it. And I feel bad about that. So I want to try to emphasize the positive here, even though it's number 7. What it comes down to is Prince Caspian has some of my favorite, it literally does, I think, has my favorite, like, ideas in the series. And it's some of the things I find myself thinking about over and over again. The concept of the old days coming back, the concept of the Pevensies coming back, and now they're characters out of Caspian's bedtime stories. I love that idea so much. And I just think it doesn't have as satisfying of a narrative as the other books. Really amazing ideas, amazing scenes, love Cornelius and Caspian on the tower. That's like one of the iconic scenes in the series for me. I could go on and on and on. But I got to fight or grab a way to break the tie with all these other books one way or another. And I just think the narrative, it doesn't hook me and keep me turning the pages the way the other books do. So Prince Caspian is at the bottom of my list, but it is a great book. Love the themes of the old days have to be restored. So I love the treasure chamber scene. So many great lines. It is my sword, Rindon. With it, I killed the wolf. There are dwarves still, and I've seen one at last, you know. And of course, it's the introduction of Reaper. I could go on and on and on and on and on. But yep, I put it at 7 out of 7, and I think it's been that way for a long time. And it is the consensus every single time we do a poll on Narnia Web. It always ranks, you know, asking what's your favorite Narnia book, it always ranks 7 out of 7.
Pretty much always.
But I guess you're switching your vote. So tell me, is it the last battle?
My number seven is the last battle. It is the last battle.
Ooh, I just read it in your eyes.
You read squat. Yes, it's the last battle. Why? Because yours is number 6.
Yeah, you're right. You only have a 720p webcam. I definitely did not read it in your eyes. Actually, I said it because I posted the thread in the Talking Beast Facebook group asking, hey, go ahead and rank your Narnia books. Just curious what people would say. And RJ Contry and Jimmy and Sean and Jason and David and Jesse and Jonathan and Cody and Nick and Emmanuel and Andrea and others posted their lists. And I just noticed Last Battle was kind of near the bottom. So I took a guess and figured maybe you're
yeah.
The last
so
battle.
No, I thought about it and I thought, you know, because of course the ending's so fantastic and it is a gripping story. But I thought, you know, which ones do I kind of keep coming back to? And I think the Prince Caspian, for one thing, as time has gone on over these almost 10 plus years, with the movies coming out, and it's been over 10 years since Prince Caspian came out, I'm a little more distanced from Prince Caspian because for a long time I was in this kind of movie maker mode, partly from my holdovers in college where I thought, I'm going to make it someday in Hollywood. And obviously that never happened. Otherwise I wouldn't be doing this podcast.
Same here.
No, We'd be making the Narnia movies.
Oh well,
we'd be making the Narnia movies
instead. But we're doing the Narnia podcast.
It's okay. But no, I thought, you know, the number of characters that I love in Prince Caspian, the number of scenes like the ones you mentioned, and so many of the themes of chivalry, of rejuvenation, of kind of this confrontation on really a very secularist and religiously nude view of the world that the Telamarines have.
In Prince Caspian.
In Prince Caspian. It's so fascinating to me, and I keep thinking about it. I find myself, when I think about The Last Battle, a lot of times I'm thinking about the dynamics at the ending. Right, with the new Narnia that they find, and then they're going further up and further, and there's always something being peeled away, like onions. Sorry, I couldn't resist, but that level of depth to The Last Battle is really intriguing, and the way that C.S. Lewis portrayed the afterlife is really unlike any other piece of literature I've seen it done in. But again, a lot of that's the ending, and not to diminish other virtues in The Last Battle. But I thought, you know, I do enjoy the story of Prince Caspian, and there's a reason it's number 6. But I thought, you know, Prince Caspian is number 6 for me, and The Last Battle is really my number 7 because I think I just don't find myself reminiscing about The Last Battle as much. And honestly, I haven't reread it as much as Prince Caspian.
Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons maybe a lot of people haven't reread it as much is it really does play as the final act of a 7-book series. It doesn't really stand alone as much. And I might say that similar to Prince Caspian as well. Prince Caspian really is, you have to read it as another chapter, like a follow-up to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think.
Yeah, a lot of the really books would stand, like if you got really screwed up and someone said, if you misunderstood someone and they said, this is the first book, The Silver Chair. I've heard of accounts where people came into the Narnia stories with the Silver Chair being the first one, and you know, the introduction to Aslan is so unique, you know, and it works for them. But yeah, I agree. Prince Caspian, The Last Battle, I think maybe that's part
those
of
are
it.
Probably, those are probably the only two that you couldn't just pick up off the shelf and start reading.
It would be very confusing.
You need some context. Yeah. But the other five, yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah, so yeah, for both of us, and we'll just go ahead and go on to my number six, which, yeah, is The Last Battle. So I guess you
called it.
Read it in my eye. And yeah,
I
and
read it in your eyes.
And I realize now that you say that, though, maybe that is, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, those are the two books that you don't stand alone, that you need the context. And that's not like a bad thing, but you need the context of the rest of the series to really appreciate. And one thing I kind of notice is it's a similar thing. Why is it lower on my list? Is because Last Battle, I think the first half of The Last Battle has a really great narrative. The second half, and you know what I'm talking about, I'm not exactly sure where the dividing line is, but once we get into the real Narnia and such, a lot of intellectually fascinating ideas.
It's almost more like The Great Divorce.
I was about to say that! Literally, I was opening
I read it in your eyes.
You read it because I've got the 1080p webcam, so... you read it in my eyes.
I've got the Zoom on speaker view. That's why it works.
Because you wouldn't pick it up off the shelf. But you went, oh, I'm looking for a good fiction book. What would you recommend? The Great Divorce wouldn't do it for you. That's not the point. It's using characters and a bit of a narrative as a vehicle to explore certain concepts. But it's not designed to be a great narrative. So I think that Last Battle, the first half, there's so many unexpected twists and turns. And so many scenes... like where Shift takes the fact that they've stolen Puzzle and uses it against them. Then I'm like, what? And then Tash showing up. There's moments of horror and shock that you haven't had anywhere else in the series. And I love that. So gripping narrative moments. And the second half, although it's great as the ending of
Is it really even the last second half? It's really more like the third act.
Yeah, it's not quite the second half. But I think of it as almost like a two-act book.
Really, I would say like the first act is like with Tyrion and then once the... once Eustace and Jill show up, it's really kind of like sets off the second act. And then,
sure, fair enough. But you know what I mean. Like, yeah, they're two very distinct. There's a very distinct transition where it's like, whoa, yeah, we're in a different story now.
Mr. Tumnus comes back for crying out loud.
Yeah. But I think the first half is narratively very compelling. And the second half, although it's especially if you've been, you know, it's a way of kind of discussing a lot of ideas that have and themes that run through the whole series, and it's a satisfying culmination of the series in that sense. But narratively less satisfying than the other books, and that's why I have it as my number six. And really quick, let me just say, the second time I read the series, this is one of the reasons this was such a shock. My second time reading the series, Last Battle ranked number one. It was my favorite book, and it's weird because I still think of it as like when you see Last Battle, I remember all those great moments. And so I would have said, oh, yeah, it's probably near the top somewhere if I had thought about it casually. But yeah, I'm really surprised. But hey, you got to have something lower. That's just the way it is. And Last Battle came out at number six. And actually, I'll get my number five in a second here. And my number five was my favorite book. First time you read the series. And now they're five and six. So things have completely flipped around for me the last...
So what is your number five?
Oh, yeah. I guess it's my turn because we're going back and forth, right? Like we're switching who goes first. Is that the idea?
Well, six was like... six and seven came in tandem, whatever.
So yeah, so I'm going first for five. So my number five was my favorite book the first time we read the series. And somehow it's all the way down at number five. And this is one of the ones where it's like I knew I had a bit of a tie between Last Battle and this book. And I'm going, which one do I do? Five and six. I don't know what to do. I had to think about it for a while. And it kind of came down to an intellectual decision of saying, well, my favorite character and my favorite scene are in this book. So I'll go ahead and put it ahead at number five. And that's the Silver Chair, of course. My favorite character, Puddleglum, it has my favorite scene, which is when Jill meets Aslan and Aslan gives her the signs. That's my favorite scene in the series. And yet for some reason, it's number five. So yeah, that was kind of the tiebreaker there. I could go on and on and on, but all the things I love about the Silver Chair. Why is it all the way down at number five? I guess there's four books ahead of it. That's why.
it also used to be my favorite book. I will tell you, the Silver Chair did used to be my favorite book.
I still love this book. Favorite character, favorite scene, but it ended up at number five because there's four books in front of it. That's all I can say.
But it kind of gets to like my number five, actually, which is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Okay.
Which...
The classic, the first one.
Yes, and it's... I feel kind of bad that it's on the bottom half, but I guess part of me feels like... Because it's one of the shorter books, actually. Part of me feels like, as I read it, and I look at the characters, and I look at things Lewis did, even in Prince Caspian, there were so many things I felt like he improved on. Just some of the dynamics between...
Oh, you see his writing style. If you're reading in publication order, which you should be, you do see his writing style develop, absolutely.
And I think that's not a slam on the book. It's... Because to a certain extent... Yeah, if I were, hey, you're going to go to an island and you can take 10 books and you can only pick one of them from the Chronicles of Narnia, then I'd probably pick The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But to a certain extent, it's not an indictment on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I think that his writing got so much more interesting and better. And just the interesting characters, like, you know, the fact that I don't think he could have come up with the character of Puddle Glum when he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a fascinating character, and even the way that Jadis is portrayed in The Magician's Nephew, and even the dialogue compared to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So that's why The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because I do keep coming back to it, and there are so many great things about it, but I think that for me, and I feel bad because I feel like I'm especially on the bottom half of the books, you feel like you're just slamming the books, like, well, this book is on the bottom because of this one.
I said it at the beginning, let me just say it one more time, that obviously these are seven great books we dearly love, but sort of because of the nature of having to say, well, we got to make a list, which means if I say this one's four, that means that, well, there's one that's three that could have been four that could have been three. Like I have to, are forced to kind of look for the negative a little bit. So I'll just say it one more time. Obviously, we have a Narnia podcast and we dearly love all seven books. This is just part of the process of narrowing it down. I feel dirty. After this is over, I'll take a shower and go reread them all again because they're all lovely. By the way, really quickly, I just want to, because like I feel like, oh, I keep wanting to give that disclaimer, but this is such a hard thing to do. A great place to really get into the nitty gritty of all the different books is the Narnia Web Discussion Forum, and I mentioned that because they just revamped it. We just updated it, and it works a lot better on mobile devices for one thing. And huge, huge props to the Rose Tree Dryad news poster on Narnia Web, who, you know, whatever it was, I guess it was last year, maybe it was the year before that, totally redesigned the Narnia Web homepage. Now she has redesigned the Narnia Web forum as well. It's a lot better, a lot easier to use. Anyway, all this to say, narniaweb.com, click forum, hope to see you there. And thank you to the Rose Tree Dryad for all the work you put into it. But on to our number fours, and I think it's your turn to go first.
So my number four is, can you guess? Go ahead, read my eyes.
I'm going to say Magician's Nephew.
Thorsen's Boy.
Oh, that was... I had it narrowed down to four. And I thought about that one.
So the Horse's Boy, it used to be probably my second favorite at one point, and I still love it. So part of the reason I kind of downgraded it is I guess some of the themes I don't... I guess just in comparison,
this is so hard.
I know.
The negative stuff.
But,
I hate it.
But you know, part of the reason it's above some of the others is, boy, it's just such a great adventure story. I just really love. I mean, it's Arabian Nights and Narnia. It's such a fantastic adventure.
Like.
Yeah, I love the characters, even to an extent, Shasta. In some ways, I think he is intentionally the most boring character. But at the same time, he's boring in that, well, he's not the anti-hero like Wolverine. He's not the, you know...
Wolverine and Narnia.
Yeah, hey, it's the spinoff.
Netflix,
it's the
listening?
Netflix spinoff, dude. So it's the, what is it? The, not the multiverse, the... Expanded universe.
Yeah, well, we can talk about that in the post chatter when we're talking about the how kid friendly we want Narnia to be. We can talk about the Wolverine spinoff.
Yeah, but even you know with some of the characters, people are like, oh well, Shasta's not that interesting. But in some ways, like especially if we look at the dialogue at the end, he's made to be that way. Yes, to a certain extent, the events kind of carry him along. But it's you know it's, honestly a lot of times. Life kind of carries us along to things, places we might not expect. And it's how you respond in those circumstances that are just as important as the paths that you set for yourself. And yeah, it's just such a great adventure story. I love it. And that's why it was my second favorite, probably for years and years. But
now you hate it.
Oh, stop. But
and
you know we talk about the horse's boy is very cinematic, and part of the way story being cinematic is not bad, and it is a very I will say it's a very fun book for me to imagine as I read the book and I'm kind of playing it out in my head. It looks spectacular in my imagination. I love it. I feel like it is the quintessential example of like, when Lewis would talk about, well, there were many adventures in Narnia, and I feel like this is a Narnian adventure, because there's in what I like that everyone there is just of that world, and you don't have the same dynamic of, well, here's an outsider's perspective coming into this magical kingdom. You don't have that, and so that it gets kind of a little variation of the normal in Narnia in terms of the format, because that is the Narnian normal for most of the characters that we love. They're experiencing a world kind of like the horse and his boy, not the, well, I went through this, I don't know, what is it, a portal, a new dimension? What is this?
Right. And it was really fun to see the Logos Theater play in South Carolina together.
That was fun.
Okay, let's keep things moving here, though. My number four, I'm relieved to, I really didn't think through that, yeah, we're gonna have to spend a lot of time talking about the negative, I guess. So I'm relieved that with this one, I think I can talk more about the positive, because this one was probably my least favorite or second least favorite for a long time. And after doing this list, realized, oh, it climbs a few spots. And that's The Magician's Nephew I'm putting at my number four. Used to be close to the bottom, maybe not the bottom at one point. And
you're a hater. Talk about Grum.
Right? Well, I'm going to talk about the positive here, okay? It has gone up because I feel like I relate to the theme. The themes hit me so much more personally as an adult than they did when I read it when I was 12 years old. And what Diggory is struggling with and the choice he has to make about his mother. I've always thought that was a powerful scene, but now it like really makes me cry. And for some reason, as an adult, it's like I feel like I get it more. Whereas, again, maybe it comes back to the narrative thing a little bit, whereas the narrative didn't grip me as much. It did grip me, just not as much, okay? Stop. I know what you're thinking. One day I'm going to do an episode about comparing Uncle Andrew and Reepy Cheep, and I think there are some shocking similarities there, but one is the dark version, one is the light version. But
like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Sure, let's go with that.
Okay, I'll buy.
But
I'll listen.
Like when they're exploring other worlds, going through Charn, and Lewis just gets into that, oh my gosh, it's another world. They could find anything. It's so spooky and scary. And I think it's probably the most overall well-written of the seven, like just sort of objectively speaking, whatever that is. I think it's Lewis's prose are amazing. And the way he sneaks atmosphere, continues the story, but sneaks his atmosphere in there is incredible. And I think it's one of the most thematically kind of tight and consistent of the series as well. And for that reason, I am awarding it the enviable spot of number four on my list.
Well, there you go. We'll just keep talking, Glenpuddle, because it's your turn to do number three.
Darn, it is. I haven't had a chance to catch my breath, all this positivity. So
Glenpuddle's not used to positivity.
I'm not.
I
love it. Yes.
I'm talking about happy things. What's that like?
That screen name has followed me around, but I don't regret it because I like it. What can I say? It's unique. So my number three, this is we're getting to the surprise that I talked about, that I went, what? Because this is the book that for years and years and years, without even really thinking about it, I would have said was my number two. But it's not. And I really, this is the one I agonized over the most out of my list. And so, yeah, I'm putting The Horse and His Boy at number three on my list. And again, I got to resist the temptation to,
it's been downgraded for both of us.
Yeah. it's more, it really, I can't really come up with any reasons why it's gone. Cause it has more to do with my number two. Cause I love my number two.
Yeah, it's
so
because,
much.
Well, same for me. You know, because it's my number four. It's
no,
because
you hate it. I saw your eyes and your 720p webcam. I could tell.
It's because we've recognized virtues in other books. Mm-hmm. Not to say there aren't virtues in The Horse and His Boy, but we're like, oh my goodness, at this point in life now, I appreciate this book more.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I love the horse. I love the character of Shasta. Yeah, he's not the most thoroughly developed character in the Chronicles, but I think... I love, one of my favorite lines in the book is when he says, "Oh, my father, what is there beyond that hill?" And I just love that he finds out he's a prince. I love it. He knew in his blood, this can't be all that there is. And there's so many great atmospheric scenes in the horse. I love the Tombs of the Ancient Kings is one of my favorite scenes in the series. It's a creepy ghost story scene in the Chronicles. And I love the character dialogue. I think it's the best character dialogue in the series. And I think that of the series, this is the one in which the characters feel the most real to me. This is the one where I can really imagine. This is true with all the Narnia books. It's amazing how with relatively little, Lewis really makes them feel real. He's an incredibly economical storyteller. He really makes them with so little, does so much. And I think that's probably the most true with The Horse and His Boy, in that I love the way the characters are just designed to just butt heads. And I buy that they hate each other and love each other at the same time. They're such different people, but I also buy that they would have this bond by the end. So yeah, Horse and His Boy, very, very surprised. Is number three for me. I've been saying this is the one I got to go back and re-edit all the episodes because I've been saying it's my it's been saying it's my number two for so long.
Well, I echo everything you're saying on The Horse and His Boy, but I had to place The Silver Chair at my number three.
Okay, so a few spots above.
So The Silver Chair was my favorite book for the longest time, and I think so much of what made it my favorite was the Aslan's Country at the opening, which
weird, my favorite scene.
You have it as the climax in the third book, in The Voyages of the Dawn Treader, and then it's the opening, you're just there. You know,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
you know,
that's true.
You know, it's like, oh, instant level up. But, you know, Jill's just there. And
which, it's a great continuation from Dawn Treader.
It is, but it's so interesting because it's like, oh, you know, it's like, well, your starting point is level one in Narnia.
Right.
you know, make your way to Cair Paravel to level up to level five. You know, no,
it's
you're
like
in
that place
country.
That place you almost saw at the end of Dawn Treader. Here you go, right in the opening page.
I think so much of it. Yes, it's you know that Rillian is the man in the mask is Rillian. But I think because of. So much of it has some of the most well-written dialogue, whether it's with the owls or the Lady of the Green Kirtle at the end, or Aslan at the beginning. It has some of the best dialogue in all of the books. And I like road trip books. I do. I think that's why The Fellowship of the Ring is maybe my favorite of the Lord of the Rings books.
Yeah.
You know, The Horse and His Boy, it's a road trip book. Silver Chair, it's a road trip book. I just love that. I love, you know, they're going through all these different places. And again, it kind of, for some of the same reasons, the classic adventure story. Plus it's got Puddleglum, who's, just one of the most interesting characters. Cause I just think he's such an original character, not my favorite character, but I don't know of other people who've done such a good job making because it'd be so easy to make Puddle Glum a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
To make him just
Eeyore.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. It'd be so easy to make him Eeyore.
Yeah, Eeyore is a delightful character because he's a type, because he's simple. That's what we love about the Winnie the Pooh books, is that the characters have these very clear-cut, identifiable characteristics, and that's kind of it. That's part of the pleasure of it. And I think in the world of Narnia, we do, part of the pleasure of it is that they feel so real, even though they're fairy tales.
Yeah. Well, now I guess it's my turn to do number two, right?
Let me think here. So I went first for 7 and 5.
And 2 is your big surprise.
There's more to come.
So my number 2 is The Magician's Nephew. Really, for all the reasons that you said.
Cool.
Because it is so well written. It is such a wonderfully balanced dynamic between Diggory and Polly.
Yeah, they have a great relationship.
And I think that it is... It probably was a very personal book for Lewis, because he gave his character the happy ending that he did not have. And I'll be honest, I almost don't want that in a book, because like, I wonder if I were an author, would I give a character, say a situation where his son was healed,
mm-hmm.
when mine was not.
Right.
Cause but Lewis of course was much older and he was farther from that. And so it's weird, cause I almost thought, oh, I almost wanted a sadder ending, maybe so I could relate more. But at the same time, I love that was what Lewis chose for his character. When he could not have, it's almost like a selfless gift to a fictional character. It seems very strange to say that.
Yeah, there can be a tension sometimes between fantasy being, on some level, it is wish fulfillment. On some level, it is kind of creating the world that we wish existed. Of course, Lewis believed that the reason we long for other worlds is because we're not made for this world.
And it's that balance too, because how much do you want your fantasy to be escapism?
Yeah.
But then you can't feel like you got to believe it. Well, not just you got to believe it. You have to relate. It has to speak to real truths. Because if you feel like, you know what, these characters are operating by, I'm not talking about like physical rules. I'm talking about like supernatural, interpersonal rules, right? That just don't apply to you. You lose engagement with the characters. So it's that balance.
And I mean, yeah, it's that balance of, I mean, to some extent, I think we both agree, we almost look to fantasy as give us a version of the world or as perspective on our world that kind of makes it make sense. Because it's so easy to look out the window or turn on the news and we just see chaos.
I kind of hate to say that, but you know how. So a comedian will make a joke, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they could be saying outlandish things, but the only reason that the only way a real joke gets to be really funny, like say, think about jokes about politics, right? The only way it gets to be really funny is if it's true.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think to an extent, that same principle applies to fantasy. It can be outlandish, it can be crazy, it can be whether it's sci-fi, fantasy, but it's not going to resonate unless it feels true.
And yet, as much as we love fantasy for being, well, fantastic, if there isn't something about it that doesn't ring true, then it's probably not going to do it for it. It would do it for you. And that's what I think all 7 Chronicles and Narnia books do, is they have this appearance of fantasy, but they just ring so true and so real at the same time. And with Magician's Nephew, yeah, with Diggory's mother being healed. I didn't lose my son, and I haven't lost anybody. I haven't felt what you have before. I can't look at it from that perspective. But I have had the same thought about Lewis, because if you know anything at all about Lewis and losing his mother, you can say he's giving his character the happy ending he wished he had.
He was 8 years old, I think.
Yeah, but I think for me it. I think that because the story goes to such a dark place, and you really feel like Diggory's mom's not going to get healed for the longest time, and because Diggory still
because he gives it up because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, it feels. I guess the happy ending feels fairly earned. because it's gone to such a dark place for so long. And what Diggory did, thinking he wasn't going to get his mother back, makes it feel earned. That's my perspective on it right now. But I really appreciate your perspective on it, especially what you've gone through this past year.
I don't know. Recently, I was thinking about it, because instantly it was not on my first gut reaction. I don't think it was my number two.
Interesting. That's really interesting. All right, so that brings me to my number two, and this is, I think, of all one. Yeah, this is I've really been surprised. There's a lot of them, but this is a book I've really given a bad rap for a long time. That I would say, yeah, this is the least, in some ways, the least well written of the series, because you can see how
COVID.
You can see how. Yeah. Oh, sorry. It's just allergies.
That's Are we social distance? Line. Does it transmit through the microphone?
I hope not.
I don't know. The CDC and WHO haven't said yet.
Wash your hands, listeners. Wash your ears.
Sterilize your butts.
Yeah, you never know. Seriously, the pandemic is very seriously, obviously. I'm not trying to belittle it. You're the one that tried to belittle it, to be clear.
You're the one making excuses right now.
I feel the need to make excuses.
You either laugh or you cry. There is a lot of horrible things that have resulted from, like, truly horrible things. And the comedy is not to make light of it. The comedy is to get through it, okay?
Okay,
it's not
there
fun
you go.
For anyone right now.
Thank you for bailing both of us out of that one. Wow, that was a great recovery. But speaking of recovery, I think I need to... I've been giving this book a bad rap for a while. It's like, oh yeah, that was when Lewis was just getting started, you know? And so... you can see how his writing style got better and better. But yeah, obviously I'm talking about my number two, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And if you'd have casually asked me again, oh, where does Wardrobe rank? I probably would have said, oh, it's probably four at most, maybe five. But as I was sitting there, this is probably more of an emotional... I don't know. This is really... It's more of an emotional or an intellectual thing. I don't know. It really is a little of both, because my heart was really kept pulling me to put Wardrobe higher. And I think
you feel like it deserves to be higher.
No. It's really, there is something about this book that is unbreakable. There's something about this story that's kind of perfect in its simplicity. I almost say, if you're doing an adaptation, look, you just stick to the basics. You're going to end up with something that's at least okay, because it's just, there's something about the basics of what Lewis did that's just, you can't mess up this story. And I think, whereas a lot of, I've tended to reward the other books for, oh, they're so rereadable. And usually what I mean by that is I read them over and over and I get something new out of it every time. So what's really interesting about Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is I don't necessarily feel that way. I feel that I'm having the same experience I had when I read it 20 years ago. Hmm. And that might sound like I'm damning it. It's the opposite. Like, it still feels new.
No, it doesn't get old.
Every time. But just to say that, you might think, oh, you're saying that you haven't really noticed anything about it. All the other books you have grown and changed and evolved and grown up with you, Wardrobe not so much. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's still fresh. I'll still get caught up in the Beaver's dinner table conversation. And then when it's, oh, I say, where's Edmund? I still go, oh my gosh, Edmund's gone to the witch. I still have this reaction. And there's something about this story that just refuses to get old. And the fact that I can still read it now and I still feel like I'm back on that couch right, like at 3 o'clock in the morning 20 years ago when I first read this book, and I'm having the same experience. There's just something timeless about this story that if you could Lewis have developed characters more, could he have developed themes more? He could have. I bet the book would have been – I bet you intellectually – I would have liked the book more now, but I bet you would have been lower on my list. There is something Lewis just made a mousetrap with this. He just made something that is perfect in its simplicity.
And here's the other thing: it is so many people, and it's not a secret that it's the word Lewis would use was a supposal. Suppose the Christ figure went into another world and decided to redeem that world where the animals were the people. How might that have happened?
Yeah.
And that's the best, because it's not,
I mean, not allegory, not symbolic.
No, I mean, if you want true allegory, read The Pilgrim's Progress, but that's like a true allegory where everything means something. But he's able to bring out these things and show them in a way where you think, well, wait a second. You know, it kind of makes you look at it the same thing a different way.
Gets past the watchful dragons.
Yeah, you look at the same thing in a different way.
Yeah. And I appreciate you bringing up the... that it's not allegory. Daughter of the King just recently wrote up a great little write-up about that on Narnia Web. You should look that up. But the headline is Why C.S. Lewis Said That Narnia Is Not Allegory at All.
Yeah, again, and, if you want to read allegory, a book like The Pilgrim's Progress is truly, like, that is, every character means a different person. Every place is a different thing. You know?
Here's the part where I bring Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter into this podcast. Which you must have known was coming sooner or later.
Well, I knew it was going to be in the next three podcasts. I just didn't know which one.
So I'm kidding, but so here's the way I like to explain it. Because it's silly, but it's effective, I think. So in Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which, look, all you have to know about it is Abraham Lincoln. It's like a story where Abraham Lincoln is a vampire hunter.
Haven't seen it. I want to.
But that's all you don't watch it. But that's all you have to know. Okay.
Okay.
So in that story is Abraham Lincoln is the main character an allegory for Abraham Lincoln? No. Is he symbolic of Abraham Lincoln? No. He's a supposal. What if Abraham Lincoln was hunting vampires as he was working out the Civil War? He is a supposal. He's a what if. Mm-hmm. I just find that's a really effective example. That's what Aslan is. Aslan isn't symbolic of Jesus, or it's not an allegory for Jesus. He's literally supposed to be Jesus. Hey, like right now, if other worlds do exist, and the Christ of this world also appeared to that world and had to redeem them too, what might that look like? What might be going on right now if that's the case? So it's not an allegory. It's not a symbol. It's a supposal. Almost a little bit. Just a little bit, mind you, science fiction-y in that way, in that it's a what-if kind of question.
Well, in science fiction...
Just a little bit.
...is at its best when it allows you to look at the things... It illuminates truths that are in your world.
And Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe does that for me, and I haven't given it the respect it deserves. It's like on an intellectual level, yes, like it's not as well written maybe as the other books, but I think it's almost like, would it be better if it was more developed? I don't know. I think it's just perfect in its simplicity, Lewis. And I think beyond being the first book, I think that's one of the main reasons it's the defining classic that everybody knows, that whether they've read the rest of the series or not. I think there's something about it that's just timeless and perfect. And I'm now that I kind of realize that, I realize it's number two on my list and realize how much the story still works for me and affects me 20 years later, I'm going to give that some thought as to what is it about the story that's just timeless. It's just the mousetrap.
Well, so I feel like a jerk. I put it at number five. Thanks a lot, dude.
I kind of think of you as a jerk too. So there you go. Well, we're finally at number one, and for those keeping score at home, yeah, I think you know where this is going. Let's just say it at the same time. Drum roll, please. Our number one,
The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
I was kind of trying to make you guys wonder, did Glumpuddle change his favorite book? No, I changed my second favorite book.
Road trip book.
It is another road trip book.
Very episodic.
Dawn Treader.
It's Jason and the Argonauts and the Odyssey and Narnia.
What's not to like?
It's awesome.
The
characters, the dialogue, some of the best dialogue, really between, it's centering around Eustace and Reepicheep. And I got to also say, Corey Arkin, fabulous dialogue there.
The first time I read the series, I read it really, really fast. Like, I didn't spend more than 2 days on each book. And then my second time I disciplined myself and said no more than two chapters a day. I forced myself to read it. So the first time through it was The Silver Chair was my favorite. Second time through, I really disciplined myself and said no more than two chapters a day. Let's go through these slowly. And after that, Last Battle was my favorite. The third time through, it was Dawn Treader, and it's remained Dawn Treader ever since. And it definitely, it's the most episodic of the series, and each episode, if you will, pulls me in so much, and I get so drawn into what are they gonna find, even though I know what they find. It works so well that you're reading it and you kind of forget what's coming next. Then you turn to the next chapter and it's like, oh yeah, it's the Dufflepuds next. And it's because there's so much stuff in it. And I think that's one reason.
You know, and that's the thing I find is so many times in stories and movies that are coming out now, there's a misunderstanding of originality for chaos. Mm-hmm. A chaotic storyline that is disorderly and doesn't make sense and is impossible to predict. Where like basically the whole thing is like it's almost like this non sequitur. Like, wait, how did we get from A to B? You know, now we're at Z. It's mistaken for, oh well, that was original. You didn't see that coming, did you? See, it's not formulaic.
I feel like I've been trying to put this into words for years and I still can't quite do it. Like, it's why it's my number one. I mean, like there's the obvious stuff, like I just mentioned. I love the, you know, like it's a magical world. They're sailing into this unknown part of a magical world. There's no rules. They could find absolutely anything.
I think it's just the most enjoyable book for me. Just for, I don't know, maybe I could make a math equation out of it. I don't really think life works that way, but it's just for a combination of reasons. It's well-written. I love Reepy Cheep. There's some of my favorite characters in there.
Oh, Reepy Cheep.
There's some of my favorite dialogue in there. There's some of my favorite scenes in there. There's some of the most creative, you know, scenes in there.
In a way, it's funny. In a way, it has the least compelling plot in that there's no bad guy. There's no, here's the thing we're trying to do. I mean, there is, but the Seven Lords thing is not that exciting. That's not what the book is about. It's the, what are they going to find? It's not the fact that, oh, we have to find the Seven Lords. I feel this emotional attachment to the Seven Lords and their well-being. It's not that at all. I don't care about them, really.
But
the fact that they left and they never came back. What does that mean? What happened? I have to know. And it's a magical world, an unexplored place of a magical world. Like, anything could have happened to them. And I think when they, in the hope of getting to Aslan's country, and they hype, and Lewis hypes it up so well, what's going to happen at the end when they get there? And amazingly, I think Lewis actually delivers. You would think it'd be that thing that you could just never deliver on, you know, Aslan's country and hyping it up and the end of the world. But Lewis, it's so beautiful, and Lewis does such a good job at just giving you a little bit of description and letting you fill it in with your brain, kind of direct your own personal movie in your head, that it does deliver. It does feel compelling. It makes me long for other worlds so much, which is part of Lewis's desire for this, I think. Like, again, he's sort of playing off the idea that we're not satisfied with this world because we were made for another one. And I think that all the Narnia books, to varying degrees, make me go, man, I wish that was real. But none more so than The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. It breaks my heart. Literally, I'm reading it. I so badly want to get on that ship and look beyond the world. I so connect with Reepy Cheep when he says, you know, they ask, if we sail off the end of the world, what are we going to find at the bottom? And he says, I don't know, but whatever it is, won't it be worth anything just to look beyond the world for one moment? And I so relate to that. And I can't think of a single other work of fiction where I've wanted to be at that place more. When Reepy Cheep is in that coracle and goes over that wave, oh, I want to be I would have made it sink, but I want to be in that coracle with him, and I want to see what's over there. That tease, and you know what we see in the silver chair, and I guess the last battle, that's cool and all, but I love that. I kind of forget about that when I'm reading Dawn Treader, and I just imagine what could be over there beyond the edge of the world, and I want that so badly, it makes me weep. And that's true to some extent with the other books, but none more so than Dawn Treader. And that heart, that the fact that it makes me so happy, but it breaks my heart at the same time. It just, when I read Dawn Treader all the way through, that ending just crushes me. And the other books don't do that to the extent that Dawn Treader does, and that's why it's my number one.
I think that following up on that and dovetailing on what you just said, I think that the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it shows so much of life, and you look at, okay, why are we here? And we talk about a happy life, especially, you know, in an American context, the phrase "the pursuit of happiness" is ingrained in our psyche. And for those who like reading C.S. Lewis, one of the best essays you can find of his is where he actually kind of addresses that phrase in the Declaration of Independence, where it's called "We Have No Right to Happiness." But it's a great exploration on what is happiness. And we think of happiness in a modern context as pleasure. Well, this is what makes me feel good. I feel good, so I'm happy. In a more ancient context or classical context, happiness was a flourishing. It was a life of meaning. And I think that, certainly for me, people know that I approach these books from a biblical perspective or Christian perspective. And so, for me, it has a similar resonance to what Lewis describes. But I think I really look at The Voyage of the Dawn Treader really as kind of a capsule showing that this is life, okay? There's going to be moments of, there's going to be horrible things happening. Life's going to get tough, and life's going to have really hilarious things happen you would never predict. Really crazy, funny things will happen to you on this life journey. And so they have this course, they have this purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's not just even this truncated, well, yeah, what are you doing right now? Oh, we're on this quest, to find the seven lords. I mean, there's other things that are happening in the middle that punctuate the story to make it so much more interesting. Yeah.
I think the meat that we bring up with the meaning is really, that's kind of what it comes down to. That's the thing that's maybe appealing seems like a weak word, but what is so attractive about this series is, there is this fantasy of, the children being called into another world and they have a higher purpose, and actually they're kings and queens and they have a job to do. And I think that, the last battle, the series ends on this, sort of this question of, well, all worlds have to draw to an end at one point or another. And of course, you're reading it going, that means my world's going to draw to an end at one point or another. And then what? What did it all mean? And the book, The Last Battle, gives a scenario where it goes on forever and every chapter is better than the one before. And so ultimately, it all had meaning. It all meant something. It didn't just all become dust. And that makes me, especially the second time reading the series, maybe the reason Last Battle was my favorite is because it made the whole series come together. I thought about Diggory, and he wanted to find the Land of Youth. He wanted to find something that would cure his mother because death is not normal, and he wanted to find something that would fix it. So he was, again, wanting something else beyond the world. I think about Shasta and Horse and His Boy. Oh, my father, what is there beyond that hill? Was I really supposed to just be a fisherman? Is that it? Is that what I'm supposed to do? He knew in his bones, no, there's something more. This isn't it. I think about Rillian being stuck in Underland in the darkness and the characters being told, there never was a sun. They know there's a sun. No, the little world you're telling me is the whole story. It's not the whole story. I think about, obviously, Dawn Treader. I think about Reepy Cheep and, his desire for one glimpse of the world's end. I think about Caspian and his excitement to see old Narnia and realize that his bedtime stories are true and that the world that Miraz has painted for me, that's not the whole story. All these stories are true. And then I think about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and why was it so exciting in the first place to read about Lucy stumbling upon, let's opening a wardrobe, this mundane piece of furniture, this ordinary wardrobe, and finding a magical world and realizing that, no, this the world we see in front of us, it's not all that there is, and you might stumble into another world at any moment and find out that actually you're a king or a queen. Why is that so appealing in the first place? And Lewis believed it was because the reason we all long for another world is because there's truth in that. We're not made for this one. And so the idea of there's something more and there's a meaning, there's a purpose, that's kind of the thing that brings all together the whole series for me.
I really want to follow that up. I can't say it as beautiful as you did. That was amazing. But I do want to follow up. And I think there's this thing I see in different people, and I think it's part of human nature where it's kind of this question of, is this it? Is this it?
Exactly.
And I've even heard it in I heard it in an economic kind of debate where people were discussing how, say, 50 years ago, right? People will argue about whether people are richer or poorer than 50 years ago. But to a certain extent, we're people will say, well, we're more rich. Like, people have iPhones. They have the access to, like, their cars don't break down like they used to. They have access to a wealth of information that they never had before. There's all these access to things that they can, like, tap on and just, you know, select Prime, and then it gets there in 2 days. And there's always, but there's some question about whether, well, but wait a minute, and people talk about stagnated growth and stuff. But what I'm getting to is there's a real question of, well, wait a second, would people rather be poorer and feel like there's more to accomplish, to get in life? Or would they rather have more and feel like, but this is it?
Yeah, I think this is the core element of why these books have why we're still talking about these books 70 years later. I think that they, all the things I just said. I don't have to say it again, I guess.
Yeah.
The exact quote is, C.S. Lewis said, "If I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world." And that's from Mere Christianity. And I think that's a lovely thought. That's a great idea. But Lewis, in these works of fiction, I think makes you experience that longing more on an emotional level than on an intellectual level. And I think that's why these resonate so much, and will continue to resonate another 70 years. All right, wow, we got there. That was just a stone I had to pass.
It only took a few minutes.
Yeah, but this was agonizing to do this.
I didn't mishear what you said, right? Did you rewrite your list from the first time you wrote it out? I don't mean like years ago. I mean like when you first put it together.
A little bit, yeah.
Because I changed it over a couple days.
I think
not a lot, but a bit.
I think no. Like the first time I did it, it took me about 15 minutes. I think maybe 15 to 20 minutes.
I think I switched 6 and 7, and then I switched, I think, 2 and 3.
Yeah, I think I may have gone, like, I had my 5 and 6, my Silver Turn, Last Battle. I may have gone back and forth a few times on those. And then I kept questioning, really, is Wardrobe number 2? Is Wardrobe number 2? I've been saying Horse and His Boy for so long. It feels like a, oh my gosh, my sacrilege. Whole life is different now. Are you ready to get stumped? All right, Rillian, your question. Now, we've been talking about the Chronicles of Narnia and ranking them and, you know, the merits of each and all that, but only one of the Chronicles of Narnia received the Carnegie Medal, which is a British literary award given to the best children or young adult book of the year. Which book was it? Come on, you've got it narrowed down to 7. Only one of the Narnia books received the Carnegie Medal, the best children's book of the year. If you want, I could give you a hint.
Yeah, I'll need a hint.
I just made up on the spot.
Okay. those are the worst kind.
I wonder if it won for the same reason that the Return of the King movie got all the Oscars of the 3 Lord of the Rings movies.
Well,
that's my hint.
I'm gonna guess The Last Battle.
Got your final answer.
Well, it's either The Last Battle or Dawn Treader, but I'm gonna guess The Last Battle.
That is correct. Last Battle. Only one to get the Carnegie Medal. And, you know, I haven't looked into it too much.
I was actually thinking it would be The Lord of the Rings, The Wardrobe, but then I thought, no, it wouldn't be that one.
Yeah, if those of you that don't understand my hint, basically, I think with The Return of the King, there was this, we have to recognize the trilogy. It wasn't that it was considered the best or anything. It was just, it was really the achievement as a whole. And you do wonder if maybe, I just wonder if there was a sense of, how do we get through 7 books and not give Lewis a Carnegie? We better give it to The Last Battle.
Obviously, that is kind of a political thing, honestly.
But I don't know. I haven't looked into it or anything. I'm not familiar with it.
Right, no, with The Return of the King, it was the only one. Political thing, but yeah, predictable, but...
All right, so that's it for this super long episode. But we're gonna talk a little bit more in the post-show chatter. We're going to talk about the upcoming Netflix adaptations and how concerned we are about them being too kid-friendly or not kid-friendly enough and what that means. If you want to listen to that, you can follow the link in the description. That's exclusively for our Patreon supporters. In the next episode, we'll be celebrating the 70th anniversary of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and we're going to be talking about listing the 70 best lines in the Chronicles of Narnia. In case you were wondering, we're happy to provide you the list, and we'll be doing that just in time for the anniversary. Rillian, why don't you take us out?
Can you copy and paste the outro for me?
Oh, never mind. I'll just read it then, whatever. So hopefully I'll hear you in the post show. You've been listening to Talking Beast, the Narnia podcast from NarniaWeb.com. We post new episodes on the 7th and 17th of every month. So be sure to subscribe and give us 5 stars on iTunes. Post a comment below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. Visit patreon.com/NarniaWeb to support this podcast and get exclusive content, including more episodes. You can also email us at podcast@NarniaWeb.com, glumpuddle@NarniaWeb.com, or brilliant@NarniaWeb.com. Thanks for listening. Further up and further in.